Hey, American Hauntings listeners, it's Troy. I wanted to introduce you to something a little different that's dropping into our feed this week. A brand new show called American Dread, which was created by my friend Adam White. Adam has been a part of American Hauntings for many years and has been a guide for our haunted tours in Decatur, Illinois for at least a decade and a half. American Dread reveals the true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of the American heartland. It's a podcast for the history and true crime obsessed, the outside-the-box thinkers who know that the most disturbing history is the history that gets buried, covered up, and forgotten, which is where American Dread comes in. To uncover the truth, confront the lies, and tell the stories that some people don't want told. We'll be revealing a few more episodes of American Dread in the next few weeks, so I hope you enjoy them and that you'll let us know what you think. Thanks for listening.
Decatur, Illinois, a city of quiet neighborhoods where Sunday nights are for church, for family, for rest. But on the morning of May 10th, 1976, that peace shattered. Two young women, cousins, were found stabbed over and over again, their bodies left in the dirt on the city's edge, like they were nothing. That morning, the news traveled faster than the wind. By noon, every street corner, every coffee shop, every front porch was gripped by the same question. Who could do this? It was a question that would haunt the Freeman family for decades, and the man who could have answered it never truly did. This is American Dread, true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of American heartland. I'm Adam White, and this episode is called The Freeman Murders. The bodies were found on the west side of Decatur, dumped like garbage along West Center Street, just down from Stevens Creek. They hadn't been there long. The early morning dew still clung to the grass. The scene told a story no one wanted to hear. 15 to 25 stab wounds each. Deep, frenzied. This wasn't quick. It was violent and personal. Assistant Police Chief Horace Hoff led the investigation. Officers fanned out, combing the area, looking for anything. Patrolman Robert Pittenger made the first big find, a driver's license, then a sweater, then more belongings scattered in a ditch off Sunnyside Road, about a mile away from where the girls had been found. The IDs gave the victims names, June Freeman and Marcella Freeman. They were cousins, close in age, even closer in life. June was 22, working at a bookstore inside the Northgate Mall. And Marcella was 23, employed at Osgood & Sons, two best friends in most people's eyes, and now, gone. In 1976, Decatur had a population of about 94,000 people. Violent crime happened, but double murders were rare. That year, Illinois had a murder rate of 9.8 per 100,000 people, slightly higher than the national average. But in smaller cities like Decatur, those numbers were lower. For two young women from good families, active in church, to be murdered together, it didn't fit the pattern police were used to seeing. Sunday, May 9th. The women attended evening worship at the Boiling Springs Church of God. After the service, they went for a soda and a drive, something they did often. They cruised down El Dorado Street, where the neon lights painted the night air, and young people laughed from their car windows. School was almost out, summer was coming, and the streets were alive with the restless May energy. The family said they usually returned home around 10 p.m., but by 11:30, there was worry. By midnight, with no calls and no sign of them, worry turned to fear. Marcella's father, James Freeman, left the house to look for the girls. About 30 minutes later, he found their car parked in a McDonald's lot on East El Dorado. The restaurant was closed. The lot was empty. their car set alone in the darkness. James waited there for nearly an hour, scanning the shadows, waiting for the girls. With no return, he knew what he had to do. By 2:30 a.m., he called the sheriff's office to report them missing. Police met with James, taking down details. They didn't know it yet, but the girls were already dead. By sunrise, as the Freeman family sat at home, sick with worry, police were at the crime scene trying to figure out who these young women were. Patrolman Pittenger's discovery of their IDs connected the dots. Now came the part no family should ever have to hear, breaking the news. The girls had been found, but not in any way a parent could bear. By mid-afternoon, police appealed for leads. Local papers ran statements from friends, teachers, and church members. Reverend Dewey Zinn described them as the kind of girls who would call home if they were going to be 5 minutes late. Teachers remember them as shy but kind. June's supervisor at the bookstore could barely speak through tears. I know those two kids didn't deserve what happened to them. Miss Phyllis Garbs, librarian at Warrensburg Latham High School, remembered June as quiet but friendly. June had graduated in 1971. Miss Nancy Axe, dean of girls at MacArthur High School, described Marcella as shy and reserved, almost a loner. She graduated in 1970. Their mothers were heartbroken. They weren't wild girls, she said. They were good girls, always have been, and I know where they are now. Within 48 hours, police worked around the clock. And then, on May 12th, an anonymous caller changed everything. They had seen the cousins with a teenage boy at McDonald's that night. 17-year-old Michael Timothy Gibson. With that lead, they immediately started the search for Michael. It didn't take very long. Police found Michael at his grandparents' house on Gebhardt Street, not far from his parents' home. He'd been staying there off and on. They brought him in for questioning. During the ride to the station, Gibson began confessing, describing the stabbings, the location of the weapon, and where some of the girl's clothing had been left. What followed was a disturbing, chilling account. Michael said that on that night, May 9th, he ran into the cousins at Sandy's Drive-In. He knew them from church, but they weren't really close friends. That night, though, they talked for a while. Michael told them he was going to go look for a friend and they should follow. After cruising El Dorado a few times, he pulled into the McDonald's parking lot and asked them if they wanted to come back to his house. He needed to let his dog out since his parents were out of town. His parents were actually out of town caring for Michael's 14-year-old sister, Cindy Lou Gibson. She was going through cancer treatment during this time. The girls hesitated, then agreed. Michael suggested they ride in his car. They drove to his home on Home Park. As they walked inside, Michael said that he needed to let the dogs out back. As he returned inside the home, he saw a knife on the counter. That's when, in his words, he described it was time. He convinced June and Marcella to go to the basement. That's where they could hang out, talk. As Marcella was about to join them, she stopped to use the restroom. June went down, Michael followed. And then Michael snapped, stabbing June immediately. Marcella was unaware at the time as she started to come downstairs, only to be confronted by the chaos. She tried to flee but was stabbed repeatedly. June, already bleeding, tried to get away. Michael stabbed her again and again. The autopsy confirmed it. 15 to 25 wounds each. Later, he told the police, "There was a big mess on the floor. I better get rid of them." He loaded their bodies into the car, dumped them along West Center Street, and scattered their belongings on Sunnyside Road. Michael Gibson was born May 27, 1958. At just 17 years old, he was just weeks away from graduating MacArthur High School. He worked at Tully's Meat Market, was known as a quiet, clean-cut, and even had a nickname in school, Gibby. But behind that calm face, no one saw the monster that would emerge. Larry Ray, a clerk at Tully's Meat Market, said he's quiet but friendly. He knows things that most people don't, like CB radios. You start talking about them and he'll talk your arm off. On Monday night, just hours after the discovery of the Freeman women's bodies, Ray had spoken with Michael at the store. He didn't seem any different, Ray noted, unaware of the dark storm about to surround the boy. On Sunday, June 12, 1976, after being held in county jail, a now 18-year-old youth, Michael Gibson, was declared mentally fit to stand trial. The report came back from Dr. Dale Sutherland. He stated Michael understood what took place and the charges against him. This test was ordered by Gibson's attorney, public defender Scott Diamond, shortly after Michael's arrest. Judge A.G. Weber would charge Michael Gibson with two counts of murder, along with a lieu of other crimes. The judge would ask the public defender Scott Diamond how Michael pleads, "Not guilty at this time, Your Honor." Also during this time, police detective George McMinn would give his testimony on what Michael had said on that car ride to Springfield. During the hearing, McMinn stated when Gibson went to Springfield to be evaluated and he was given a lie detector test, it's noted that at this time, Michael remarked that he was in a bad situation before giving them the rest of the information. Multiple officers had witnessed the confession. On August 5th, 1976, Michael would waive a non-jury trial, and Judge Rodney A. Scott would find Gibson guilty of murders. And on August 20th, 1976, he was sentenced to 35 to 65 years in prison. The prosecutors actually recommended 100 to 300 years, but since Michael took that non-jury trial plea, they knocked his sentence down. Michael's imprisonment was marked by a series of unsuccessful parole attempts. Since 1984, the parole board had rejected Michael's request for parole, citing the severity of the offense and the potential for his release to undermine respect for the law. In 1987, Gibson faced his third parole denial, with the board emphasizing the gravity of the crime and the necessity of safeguarding the society. The Freeman family's tireless efforts to ensure justice was served played a significant role in the parole board's decision. In a move that many indicator would never forget, Michael Timothy Gibson, the man convicted of the savage murders of the cousins Marcella and June Freeman, walked out of Graham Correctional Center on October 8, 2002. He had just served over 26 years of his sentence. The decision blindsided and enraged the community. For years, petitions had been circulating, letters written, voices raised in the courtrooms and city hall, all with the same plea, keep him locked away. But Sergio Molina, a spokesman for the Illinois Prison Review Board, coldly stated that Gibson, now 44 years old, had served the time required by law. There was nothing more the state could do. The reaction was sharply divided. Gibson's sister, Pamela Will, claimed that the media had turned her brother into a monster and insisted it was time for everyone to move on. But for the families of June and Marcella, especially Marcella's mother, moving on was impossible. She warned Decatur needed to know he was back among them, that the man who had destroyed her family was breathing the same air, walking the same streets. Michael tried, at least on the surface, to live quietly. He found work at Claire's restaurant. He spent time fishing. He picked up a guitar. He smiled in photos. But for many in Decatur, the sight of him, even decades older, was like a knife reopening an old wound. People crossed the street to avoid him. Conversation stopped when he entered a room. And then, on Halloween Day, 2021, Michael Gibson's story ended. At the age of 63, he died at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. There was no dramatic final act, no last words spoken from Michael for the blood that he spilled in 1976, only the cold fact of his death. For the Freeman family, the news brought no relief, only a mute, uneasy quiet. The loss of June and Marcella was a wound that had never healed, and Gibson's death did not bring them back. It only closed a chapter, one written in blood, grief, and pain that would echo for the rest of their lives. For the rest of his life, Michael Gibson walked free in the world he had no right to touch. He could sit at a diner and order a plate of food. He could cast his fishing line into the Sangamon River and feel the pull of the current. He could strum a guitar in the fading lights of an evening. He had all of that. While June and Marcella lay in the cold ground, the Freeman family spent decades fighting against his release. They wrote letters. They spoke at hearings. They pleaded with the state not to open the gates. And for a time, their voice kept him behind bars. But in the end, time itself became the judge. After 26 years, the state turned the key, not because Gibson was reformed, not because he deserved mercy, but because the sentence had simply run out. The truth is, the justice system of the 1970s was not built for victims. Sentences for murders were shorter. Parole was more generous. Statistics from that decade show that many convicted killers in Illinois served less than half of their original terms before walking free. Families like the Freemans were forced to relive their nightmares every time parole came up for review, knowing the system valued calendars more than grief. When Gibson died in 2021 at the age of 63, there was no celebration, no closure, just a hollow ending to a story that had already stolen too much. He went to his grave without ever answering that one question that mattered. Why? That unanswered question lingers like weight. It's the kind of silence that doesn't fade with time. It keeps families awake at night. It shapes how they see the world. It lives on in Decatur too. A shadow in the collective memory of a city that still whispers about that May night, 1976. And that's the terrible truth about crimes like this. They don't end. Not when the killer is caught. Not when the years are served. Not even when the killer dies. The sentence is never finished, because the survivors are the ones who carry it. Marcella and June's mother never watched their daughters walk down an aisle. They never held their grandchildren. Instead, they stood by their gravesides, staring down at a name carved into a stone, asking the same question that echoed still. Why them? Why that night? Why at all? Some crimes fade into yellowed newspaper clippings and are forgotten. This wasn't one of them. This was the kind of crime that sears itself into place, into the hearts of everyone who lived there, a scar the city can't erase. And if you drive the streets of Decatur late at night, you might still feel it, the weight of what was taken, the laughter that should have filled the years that followed, the voices of two young women, gone too soon. Not screams, not violence, just the sound of Marcello and June, side by side in that car, laughing in the glow of El Dorado Street, believing they had forever. Some tragedies cling to a place, like ghosts that refuse to leave, because these aren't just stories. They are bloodstains. They are echoes. They are scars carved into the heart of the community, and some scars never fade. This was episode 1 of American Dread, true stories of tragedy and terror from the dark side of American heartland. I'm Adam White. Thanks for listening.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.